This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and five focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork.
The city of Chicago will pay $5.7 million after a jury found police wrongfully raided the home of the Tate family.
We are less than 3 weeks away from the Illinois primary.
Everyone is expecting that ICE gets reined in, and I want to see ICE be abolished.
I led the first impeachment inquiry with regard to Donald Trump.
I believe in campaign finance reform.
Hey, Chicago. I'm Mariah Wolfel in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news roundup. That's where we take you behind the headlines with local journalists working in Chicago.
The Supreme Court strikes down Trump's signature policy. He has a meltdown in the White House briefing room.
He doesn't seem to understand that $1,700 out of the pockets of everyday people across the United States is a lot of money.
We have alternatives. Could be more money. We'll take in more money.
These home-going services are welcome to all.
Nearly 500 people, from children to elders, are lined up to pay their respects.
Jesse Jackson was a good man. He fought for everybody.
We'll get into those stories and much more, but we're starting with the upcoming election. The Chicago area is buzzing with political activity as we approach the primaries. Among the big races that we're watching is the Senate race to replace longtime retiring Senator Dick Durbin. Joining me at the table to break it all down, Brandis Friedman, anchor of WTTW's Chicago Tonight and host of Chicago Tonight Black Voices, Axios Chicago reporter Monica Eng, Dan Mihalopoulos, WBEZ investigative reporter. I started by asking Brandis how the race for Durbin's seat is shaping up.
I think everybody is familiar with the big three names of folks that are running, right? Yeah. Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, Representative Robin Kelly, and Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy. But, you know, your colleagues at the Chicago Sun-Times, there are lots of people actually running. Quite a few other folks on the ballot, you know, with a range of experiences. I think at this point, the three main candidates with, you know, a lot of fundraising and a lot of support, I think they're trying to differentiate themselves at this point and trying to share their different stances on how they are going to respond to ICE and immigration enforcement and Trump's ICE specifically, their feelings on the minimum wage and whether or not they would support Trump's nominations for appointments. So I think that's where the race is right now, is the three of them trying to show their differences. Tina Svondelis at the Sun-Times is reporting that Raja Krishnamoorthy, he's really the one who has far and away out-fundraised everybody. His race right now is, according to the Federal Election Commission, ranking third nationwide in fundraising halls, only behind names like Cory Booker and John Ossoff, men who are already in the Senate. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out when we get to primary day.
And that's obviously the highest profile race. Let's turn to a race that's not quite getting as much attention, the commissioners who sit on the Cook County Board of Review. Dan, tell us, let's start first, why should this race be on our radar? And, you know, what exactly does the Cook County Board of Review do?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's very powerful, although it's relatively obscure. We would say there are three people who are elected, three different districts across Cook County, and they have a huge power, which is to decide whether your property taxes go up or down effectively. You can appeal to them after the assessor sets the valuation. Normally, you don't hear a lot about them, but they've been in the news a lot the last few years, particularly For one thing, property taxes are going up and there's a lot of finger pointing going on between the Board of Review and the assessor. There's a lot of infighting within the Board of Review. There's three commissioners, as we said. One was reelected, Larry Rogers, a couple of years ago. All three are Democrats. The two who are facing challengers are the incumbents, George Cardenas and also Samantha Steele. And she's probably best known for a DUI arrest. The case is still pending. She's fighting the charges. But there is police video, which we reported on back in 2024, where she says, you know, to the cops that she's an elected official. She's a Cook County elected official, which is exactly what we were looking for in those body cam videos.
Yeah. So you mentioned those two commissioners. Can you tell us a little bit more about them and how these races are shaping up?
Yeah, both of them have what could be pretty strong challengers. They're people who have been kind of in the background of politics for a long, long time that are challenging George Cardenas and Samantha Steele. Cardenas's challenger is Juanita Irizarry. She was the head of Friends of the Park when they defeated, you might remember a decade ago, it's been, seems like yesterday, they defeated the plan to build the George Lucas Star Wars Museum, as they called it, on the lakefront. So she was protecting the lakefront. She's an activist in the Puerto Rican community on the north side of Chicago, northwest side of Chicago. And then opposing Samantha Steele is a former aide to John Cullerton, who was the Senate president. Liz Nicholson is her name. And they have a lot of big endorsements, both of them. So they could present a challenge in the primary. And a lot of it probably will come down to the primary because, like I said, all three members of the Board of Review are Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Heavily Democratic elections across the board in these primary races.
In the county, yeah.
And I should say, you know, for folks who don't know kind of the 101 is when you get your property taxes and you're like, whoa, these are too high.
Yeah.
They're the guys you would send your appeal to. I mean, you can also send them to the assessor, but normally to the Board of Review. And so they could control, oh, jeepers, that is too high. Well, let me, you know, reduce that for you. So that's why they're so important. They could control millions of dollars for millions of people who are paying their property taxes.
Yeah, that's whether you own a condo or you're the Chicago Bears and you just bought the former Arlington Park. You know, that's been another issue that the Board of Review has weighed in on, how much in property taxes the Bears will pay on that massive former, you know, horse racing course.
We're definitely going to talk Bears later in the show. Sticking on elections here at WBEZ, we're out with a story this morning showing that APAC donors or affiliated super PACs have poured $13.7 million to favor candidates in four wide open congressional Democratic primaries. We also surveyed the 46 candidates in those races and found that those who got donations linked to APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, would not answer yes or no on putting strict conditions on U.S. military aid to Israel, which some candidates say has been the litmus test for APAC on whether they're going to support a candidate. We spoke with one candidate, Jeff Cohen. He's an economist running in the 9th District to replace longtime U.S. Rep. Jan Schakowsky, and he said he met with APAC and really got that impression that this was a strong litmus test. He himself is pretty supportive of the U.S.-Israel alliance, but said that that wasn't enough to gain APAC support. Dan, what do you make of these moves in our area during this primary, APAC and other dark money moves in these races?
Yeah, there are dark money moves with crypto interest, cryptocurrency interest. There's also, obviously, APAC has been around for a very, very long time. As you know, I think it's 72 years, you said in your story, Mariah. And why is it different now that there's more attention to this? Why are they trying to be, as I think some put it, more submerged, more sort of secretive or low profile in their approach to this election, is because of Gaza. You know, Israel has basically leveled Gaza in the last, since the attack in, what was it, October 2024 on Israel.
2023.
It's been that long. So what we have here is, you know, a situation where that's an extremely sensitive issue. Particularly, it's divided the Democratic Party. We saw that in the 2024 presidential election. And we're seeing it again here now. And for those of you who are keeping score at home, the Democrats who have gotten money from APAC and are on the ballot here in Illinois in congressional races coming up here include Cook County Commissioner Donna Miller in the 2nd District, Chicago City Treasurer Melissa Conyers-Irvin in the 7th District, and U.S. Representative Melissa Bean in the 8th District. In fact, on a couple of the screens here in the studio, I saw one of the ads for her just as we were getting ready to come on the air.
It's the season. We should be clear. It's AIPAC-linked money from donors or super PACs that have cropped up in early this year.
And you're seeing a lot of public opinion shift on it since the war in Gaza. You're seeing a lot of young people actually knowing what AIPAC is and looking for whether or not someone running for office is linked or getting money from people into that.
Yeah, and I think in our reporting we found that there's just general distaste for dark money overall, you know, of not knowing, you know, the names of some of these super PACs that are AIPAC linked are Elect Chicago Women Now or Affordability, you know, tied to affordability. And so I think voters are across the board, whatever the interest is, and candidates themselves, you know, looking for more transparency. But, you know, they're sticking on election day, there have been some concerns about people possibly staying away from polling places because of the possibility of ICE agents. But the Department of Homeland Security promised there would be no agents patrolling during this year's midterm elections. Monica, Brandis, do you think voters, especially in immigrant communities, might feel any particular way reluctant to go to the polls in March?
It's hard to say. I mean, we're almost in March. You know, we've all in this room probably dealt with the Department of Homeland Security Communications Office, and we've all dealt with statements that they've made that turned out not to really hold water under scrutiny. So whether or not there will be people outside of polling stations, I think remains to be seen. But I think the fear that has been injected into these communities over the last year is palpable, and it will be interesting to see who shows up. I mean, let's be super clear. Despite claims that there is all sorts of, you know, undocumented people who are voting illegally, that has been debunked by study after study. So the idea that people who are ineligible to vote would be showing up, non-citizens, does not seem likely, but I can still see fear stopping some people who absolutely do have the right to vote.
Definitely something to watch.
Jesse Jackson would want folks to know that, you know, if your vote weren't so important, they wouldn't be trying to take it from you, right? They wouldn't be trying to scare you out of doing it. And so I am hopeful that, you know, that folks who want to vote are not terrified of what they may or may not see outside their polling place and go do what they feel is right.
A Chicago police officer accused of improperly stopping and searching black men during downtown traffic stops has been stripped of his badge and gun. Brandis, unfortunately, this seems to be part of a troubling pattern in the 18th Police District, which includes areas like near Northside, River North, and Lincoln Park. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Right. So this is based on reporting from my colleague, Heather Sharone. And he is this officer, Richard Rodriguez, is the fifth member of this particular police district tactical team to be stripped of his badge and his gun after Inspector General Deborah Witzberg. You know, there is this database where she has identified this troubling pattern of undocumented and unprofessional stops happening specifically to black Chicagoans. And it's interesting, this particular officer is facing 28 other complaints, also named in 8 pending lawsuits. I think there's an instance after he was stripped of his police powers in the middle of a court-ordered deposition. I think his attorney was like, actually, my client won't be answering any more questions.
Oh, wow.
Because he has been stripped of his police powers right now. He's pulled over in the lawsuit filed by two motorists. They claim that they were pulled over twice without justification, once in May 2023. Again, later on in August 2023, the officer was, you know, suspended for 3 days after one of the instances accused of shoving one of the driver's face into the car during the first stop, threatened to shoot the other person during the second stop. So a lot of questions here, but this person has, for now, for what we know, been stripped of police powers, and
sticking with police, a jury found Chicago police used excessive force when searching a family's Southside home back in 2018. Dan, can you give us the details on this case?
Yeah, we're talking about the Tate family who had their home stormed by SWAT officers without knocking. We talk about these no-knock raids that the police have carried out. We had the Anjanette Young situation that was really infamous. And the Tate family goes to court, and they end up being awarded $5.7 million. There was a tip that it was some sort of illegal activity going on there, not that it involved them whatsoever, and they didn't find anything. But, you know, there was a grandmother in her underwear outside, allegedly guns aimed at the children, although the police and the city's lawyers denied that in court. But the jury went with the Tates.
Let's listen to the plaintiff and victim, Ebony Tate.
I'm just glad we have justice now. And I just pray that this will put a stop to the wrongful raids for the next family. Shouldn't have to go through what we went through.
Dan, the jury found the city of Chicago liable because of the officers' misconduct, saying the city knew officers were routinely violating people's rights.
Yeah, again, it's like this thing we saw in the 18th District that Brandis was talking about. Is this a pattern and practice of the police? And there have been federal monitors brought in, federal oversight of this department, all sorts of efforts to change the way that they do business routinely. And again, even in court, even in defeat, the city was pretty much resistant to any accusations that they did aim guns at children or that this is something that they do routinely.
You know, this raid happened before the Chicago Police Department was placed under a federal consent decree. Brandis, Chicago Tonight did a deep dive into whether CPD is actually instituting the required reforms that came with that federal oversight. What did your outlet find?
So we, monthly have a consent decree special focusing on different parts of the consent decree. This past Monday, we talked about the use of force. Something that we can all, find is that the department right now is only 23% in full compliance, meaning that whatever forms have been, reforms have been decided and written down on paper are actually being implemented and officers are being trained on them. This after 7 years. I think this weekend, March 1st, is the 7th anniversary of the consent decree. So even the judge who is overseeing this consent decree is frustrated that the pace of it has been too slow. I guess it depends on who you talk to. We had one woman on the show this week, an activist who has lots of words and adjectives for how she would describe the Chicago Police Department. But she says, the problems and, she uses the word racism. It's all sort of baked into the organization over 100+ years of its existence, and it is not going to be changed, reformed, undone in just 7 years of working on it. And that's one way to look at it. She's also not forgiving the police department for its shortcomings. There's a whole lot more work to be done, and it keeps expanding as well to bring in, I'm not sure where they stand on traffic stops. I think they did bring in traffic stops and then use of force. So, and figuring out what the rules are going to be there. So it's slow, and they've got a ways to go.
Mm-hmm. Outside of the city of Chicago, Monica, you also reported on alleged police misconduct this week in the south suburb of Dalton. What's going on there?
Well, Dalton's been in the news. The Pope is from there. The Tiffany Henyard thing. Lori Lightfoot going in and trying to clean things up. But I got this small story. It's not a $1 million settlement. It's a $30,000 settlement. But it was this law professor from Cincinnati who he lent his car to his son, who's a U of C grad student. It was parked right in front of Michelle and Barack Obama's first marital home, and it disappeared overnight. It was a 2010 Toyota Camry. And they went to report it to the cops, and they're like, oh, no, that was a crime car that's been taken, that's been seized by the Dalton Police Department.
Hmm.
You're like, crime car? My son's a grad student. He didn't commit a robbery. So they messed with the wrong guy. This is a law professor. And so he said it took about 21 days to get the car back. He claims he was shaken down by a tow company in Calumet City. The car was taken by a detective, Major Coleman, a guy who Patrick Smith, our colleague here, had investigated in a series on troubled cops. And a guy who'd been suspended from the Cook County Sheriff, had been fired by South Holland Police Department. Turned out this detective, Major Coleman, had taken the car and said, $1,400 to get it back. It's like, what do you mean? You took my car illegally. So after he paid the money, It's been 3 years, but he sued. He worked with a civil rights attorney in Chicago. He sued, and they alleged in their complaint a pattern in practice. They said that these seizures were a pattern. And in fact, they cited another guy who'd sued successfully or who got a settlement successfully from the same guy. And then his son actually played in a band in high school, and he came back to Cincinnati and he played at a bar. And he said, "Drinks on me. I got a $30,000 settlement from the Dalton Police Department."
Wow.
And so I called Dalton, and they got back to me. They said, "Oh, well, that happened under a previous administration, you know." I said, "But is this guy, Detective Major Coleman, the subject of many investigations, still employed?" "Yes, he is." And I said, "Are you going to do anything?" "This is an ongoing investigation, and thus it's private."
Hmm.
So it's just sort of like, I mean, Patrick's reporting said that there is this pattern of a lot of troubled cops who've had trouble in some departments who just kind of bounce around and go to others. And a lot of times it's in these less resourced South Suburban police departments.
Well, you got to wonder if they knew the occupation of the person they were dealing with.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in Humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
With a law professor.
Exactly. He was tenacious.
More than a week of memorial services and celebrations for the Reverend Jesse Jackson began yesterday, with hundreds lining up along Drexel Avenue on the city's south side. As recordings of Jackson's speeches blared from the speakers, Brandis, fill us in on the week-long plans to honor the late civil rights leader.
Yeah, starting yesterday, the Reverend was lying in repose at Rainbow Push headquarters. I understand starting, I guess, around 9 yesterday morning, members of the family, you know, he was taken from Leek and Sons funeral home, and he was taken into the headquarters there, where he's going to be lying in repose today and tomorrow. Family members yesterday had a few private moments before, you know, the thousands of mourners who are lined down the block to visit and pay their respects, coming from all over the country. He is doing that again today. And then there's a little bit of travel time. There will be services in South Carolina. He will lie in state at the State House there in South Carolina. Services in Washington, D.C., which at last check, I'm not sure that those were finalized just yet. And then back to Chicago for a big public homegoing, I think, is what we're calling it. Or I think there's a service and then the homegoing, which will be a private service with the family on Saturday of next week. So
okay.
A lot of opportunity for people to remember and honor. And I mean, one thing I just want to add, right? I'm not a Chicagoan. I grew up in Mississippi, but I've always known of Jesse Jackson. We all have, right? I mentioned to his daughter last night that I have known of her father as long as I have known of my own. But, you know, becoming a Chicagoan, he becomes sort of ours, right? Like he's a Chicagoan. And I'm reminded of, you know, the impact that he had and how folks from around the country and probably the world are remembering him as well and what he did. So.
Yeah, and that's probably why Jackson's family has said that all are welcome to attend, you know, the majority of services. But they said politics should be left at home. Dan, do you think that's going to be possible?
Is that really a fitting way to remember Jesse Jackson, to keep politics out of the room? Everybody was always welcome on Saturday mornings for the Rainbow Push meeting. I think we've all been there as reporters. You know, honestly, the crowds had dwindled a little bit in the past few years. But I mean, can you really keep politics out of it? Do you want to really keep politics out of it? We're talking about a family. One of his sons is a member of Congress. Another, and probably one of the more painful chapters of the Reverend's life, was a congressman and went to prison together with his then wife, who was an alderman in the city of Chicago, in that part of town of the South Side. So, and he's trying to make a comeback right now. We're in, you know, he's in campaign season a couple weeks before primary where he's trying to get his seat back. That's Jesse Jackson Jr. So, you know, no, I don't think that politics will be something that it might be more subtle and not so much electoral politics. You know, they asked, the family did, and Congressman Jonathan Jackson asked for his father to be allowed to lie in state, you know, in the Capitol. And Mike Johnson, the Republican Speaker of the House, said no. So there's been politics already around.
And yesterday when the mayor got up to speak in front of the building, he got into some politics. He was saying that the federal government is attacking us, and my hope and prayer is that people recognize our assignment is to keep that we can only keep hope alive with resistance. So he noted, you know, the federal versus Chicago thing. But then Jesse Jackson Jr. said, this is a time to lay down some of the rhetoric that deeply divides our country and reflect on a man who brought people together. So it seems like he was trying to tamp it down, but certainly there was politics as people would get up to speak in front of us yesterday. I should say I was 350th in line yesterday morning. Mm. And once the doors opened at 10, it took about 65 minutes for me to get to the front.
Okay.
It's very moving inside. You should know you can't take pictures, so don't try to take pictures inside. You can't bring water bottles. You can't bring any liquids. You can't bring any drinks. You can't bring any food. I saw gum and snacks being taken away. There are people who will be selling you stuff all along the line on Drexel. If it's a big poster, don't buy it before you go in because you're going to have to leave it on the lawn and hope it's still there.
President Trump has been invited to attend the service in Washington, but we don't know if he'll attend yet, or for that matter, which of the five living presidents will be attending services. So I imagine we're going to, you know, continue to talk about how politics is playing a role in these.
The mayor was asked yesterday if the president is going to, he said it's still unclear.
Okay. Let's move on to how the federal government is impacting us here in Illinois. The Supreme Court ruled against President Donald Trump's tariffs last Friday, but that did not bring an end to the trade policy chaos. Brandis, you had a chance to talk to a local economist and a legal scholar about this. What did they have to say?
So a few things. One of, I think the economist that we heard from, you know, his argument is that what the president is claiming about the tariffs, right, like this sort of trade imbalance or this deficit that the president is referring to, what is it, the fundamental payment problem, international payment problem, that's not really how tariffs work, right? Like there's an exchange of goods for the value of that, right? And so this sort of, and you know, I'm not an economist. I don't even play one on television, but so quote me at your own free will. But you know, he just kind of explains that imbalance doesn't really exist, that the president's argument doesn't quite hold up. I think the other concern is this new 15% tariff that the president is implementing. You know, our legal expert is saying, well, you know, it'll probably be another year before that one gets to the Supreme Court as well, because obviously that will be challenged also. So whether or not, you know, it holds up we're starting to see a little bit of the impact of like how other countries are responding to this and that, you know, it's not positive necessarily, that it gets confusing for people, obviously.
Monica, some companies and even governors were quick to demand a tariff refund from the White House, and that included J.B. Pritzker. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, last Friday, he quickly put out what is considered a trolling letter to Trump saying, oh, look what Supreme Court said. Guess what? You owe every Illinois family $1,700, and we will be making sure you pay it. So, of course, I put in a call to the White House. I said, you know, what do you have to say about this? They sent out a fat jokes, basically, and we weren't sure how much of that we should be putting in our story. But the whole thing is sort of a tit for tat, saying, look, you know, these tariffs, and really emphasizing that other countries are not paying these tariffs. This is a tariff on the American people, and Governor J.B. Pritzker estimated about $1,700 per Illinois family. But then the Trump administration put out, yeah, good luck clawing that money back. These things are going to be tied up in court for years to come if you try to get your money back.
This is In the Loop. I'm Mariah Wolfel in for Sasha Ann Simons, and we're going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap with WTTW's Brandis Friedman, Monica Ang of Axios, and WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos. Kind of sticking with the federal government's impact on us locally, Brandis, the EPA has rolled back emissions regulations. Now, some Illinois environmental activists are joining a lawsuit against the EPA. What are the details?
So the EPA, they've rolled back what's called the endangerment finding, which was, passed in 2009 or implemented in 2009, which basically says that, yes, we know that greenhouse gases are and what's happening with climate change and global warming is actually a danger to public health and safety. So the concern is that endangerment, this rollback is not based on science or data. They say that the working group that the EPA put together to arrive at this decision was cherry-picked, and that their decision was not really based on data or research. And in fact, the data and the research that we've had forever, but especially since 2009, it does indeed, in fact, show that climate change is not good for public safety and health. So without this endangerment finding in place, that means a lot of other rollbacks as far as we no longer will need to have more fuel efficient cars, right? And so the price of fuel will actually go up. So they're saying that the impact of that, it has a ripple effect, and that the United States is actually, you know, while our contribution to climate change is modest compared to, say, China, there's still enough research that shows that it's worth the change to maintain the endangerment finding and all that comes with it.
Mm-hmm. Turning to Springfield, new legislation could save consumers on hidden fees in utility bills. It would block utilities like ComEd and People's Gas from passing along certain costs to consumers, including things like advertising and trade association memberships. Here's what Brian McDaniel of Citizens Utility Board had to say about the Utility Transparency Act.
Many Illinois consumers have no idea that their electric, gas, and water bills cover tens of millions of dollars in self-serving utility expenses that have zero consumer benefit. Rather, they advance the agendas of Illinois utilities and increase their political power. A CUB analysis of documents filed in utility rate hike cases from 2023 to 2025 found that, on average, for the average year, ratepayers could save $40 million a year across Illinois.
Those costs can really add up, and we will keep an eye on what happens with that legislation going forward. But we've also got a stadium update out of Springfield. A tax incentive plan aimed at keeping the Bears in Illinois advanced the state house Thursday, despite opposition from City Hall. Dan, I'm tossing this one to you. What is the latest?
Well, if you watch the Republican governor of Indiana, Mike Braun, make the rounds of right-wing stations, and then yesterday, Pat McAfee, the former football player and popular sports talk show host, they're spiking the ball. They say they're at the goal line, but they're already spiking the ball. I don't know how well that stuff is going to age, because they have apparently also in Indianapolis already given the Bears everything that they've asked for, everything they could dream of to move to Hammond. We're still at this impasse in Springfield where it passed that committee, as you said, but it hasn't gone to a full House vote. I think the governor says they're still working with the Bears. The Bears say they're still working. And so the longer you have this position where Indiana's given them what they want and Illinois, they're still talking to them, the more it seems that they're playing Indiana for rubes, you know, for chumps. And look, I'm not going to sit here and we had a lot of listeners and our colleague Mike Puente over there in the region in Northwest Indiana. It's part of, you know, quote unquote, Chicagoland. A lot of it is closer to the Bears Stadium and to us here in the studio at Navy Pier than a lot of the other suburbs in the North Shore, wherever, you know, but it would be weird. I mean, earlier this morning, you hear this legislator, I don't know where in Indiana he was from, but, you know, they're talking about the Bears and they're talking about Dick Butkus and, you know, they don't really talk English kind of like I do. I got a Chicago accent. They have a little bit more of a country accent. And it just is, it just sounded weird
you
to hear
a Chicago
guy.
You have a Chicago accent?
It just sounded weird.
What kind of country? Like, when
the
you
Bears.
Say country.
Well, there's also, you're right, Brandis, sorry. All due respect to our friends from the South. But, you know, all of our friends from the South. But it just didn't sound right hearing him talk about the Bears like it was his team. But, yeah.
I mean, so we've got this race between Indiana, Arlington Heights, but is Chicago going to make a fourth quarter comeback here in true Bears fashion?
I don't know how we can. I mean, given that they want to control the stadium, they want to control retail around the stadium, and they want a really big stadium, I'm just not sure how Chicago could compete on that.
On the recap, we occasionally take a look at the state of local media, and this was a heartbreaking week over at WGN Television. Monica, will you please fill us in?
Sure. The station announced a lot of on-air cuts, and obviously, you know, behind the scenes and production cuts are really important, but in terms of the public, on-air cuts really do make a splash. Dean Richards, the entertainment reporter of many decades, was let go, along with sports anchor Chris Bowden. Others, Ray Cortopassi, Sean Lewis, Judy Wang, Julian Cruz, Brana Tumulty, meteorologist Mike Jansen. And I was told that later Deborah Brockman, who was part of that viral video of DHS officers tackling her, that she was let go later. Oh. It's a huge, huge chunk of on-air staff to be cut all at the same time. And, you know, a symptom of what we're seeing in the media environment in general. It's no longer Chicago's very own. It's WGN is now owned by Nexstar. And so maybe that made it easier for them to make the cuts. What do you guys think?
It's a shame. I mean, it's an esteemed outlet. I've been up to their studios off of Edison there. They're Edison and Western, and on Paul Lisnek's show and another programs. They're obviously fierce competitors for news stories as well. They're not immune, though, to the sort of things we've seen in on the radio side and certainly in newspapers over the years at all the major newspapers in Chicago and across the country, who've far fewer people gathering news for you than there were at some point. And there are a variety of reasons. You know, some would say technological. But, you know, the business side there at GN is obviously something that his but when you mentioned Debbie Brockman, you know, she was another one that was done dirty by DHS in a way, not just because she was tackled and detained for no reason, but they made all sorts of accusations against her, which I don't want to repeat. I believe they even went out there and said, you know, stay tuned, charges are coming. Oh, you know, we don't report charges until they're filed, and they never were filed. And I imagine they never will be. But that's, you know, obviously now injury added to, you know, injury and insult for her. So our hearts go out to all of our colleagues and people like her who work at the station. We're all on the team together here at WBZ, and I'm sure you feel the same way at your news outlets. It's there's more tension when it's reporters or anchors or people that are out there on the airwaves, but there are a lot of people that make this content happen and get to your ears and eyes.
It's frightening to see, you know, what's happening to our industry. Like you said, that is a very deep cut to have that many people. Like at Chicago Tonight, that would be like 8 people. That's our newsroom. You know, like that is a very deep cut. And, you know, obviously fierce competitors for news. But one thing I've learned about the Chicago Press Corps is, you know, we're still all family. And so it is frightening and it's heartbreaking when, you know, because we know these people, right? Like they're not just, you know, anchors or reporters and people that we see on television. They're our colleagues. And it's upsetting to see that happen to them, because the truth is, like in this industry, it could be any of us. And it's sad.
Longtime Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas made news this week. Pappas is known for her outspoken, somewhat combative style. But Dan, one local CEO is saying her behavior really crossed the line. Can you give us the details?
Yeah, there's a company called Tyler Technologies, which has been working for years and years and is way behind, way over budget, apparently, for some computer upgrades to the property tax system. Pappas is the treasurer of Cook County and basically accepts all the payments from the taxpayers. We were talking about high property taxes before, but there's also just the issue of getting the bills out and getting refunds that people are owed. And so she says that she became extremely frustrated, but they took the really rare step. The CEO of Tyler, which is this company based in Texas, took the very rare step of sending a letter to Pappas, copying Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle and the rest of the county board, and saying that Maria Pappas has been abusive, threatening, profanity-laced tirades, even racially tinged comments, racially charged comments to members of their team. Pappas denies the racism part, but pretty much, you know, accepted that she did the rest of the things, and she said that she was doing it, you know, for the taxpayers. So essentially she's accused of getting way overheated, and she responded by getting overheated when I and others interviewed her about these allegations.
Let's take a listen to what Treasurer Pappas had to say about her behavior.
You want me to sit here like the good little girl, the Vestal Virgin, and not say anything? Yeah, I've got a temper. Of course I've got a temper. You know what? I got a reaction out of them. So let's figure this out and let's move forward.
Dan, I want to ask you, does she have a point there, or is there more nuance to it? This is the city of politicians sending dead fish to their political enemies. I mean, politics a beanbag.
I think Rahm did that in Washington, but point taken. I'm going to defer to my colleagues as the only, you know, dude in the room here. I'm the same, obviously, Greek like Maria Pappas, and she gave me an earful in Greek as well as English about Tyler Technologies. Yeah, I mean, she thinks it's preposterous that they're trying to deflect. They say that she's deflecting from her own office's responsibility in this mess that has affected so many people and all these suburban and city school districts and taxing districts that aren't getting their money or are losing interest on the money they should have gotten already. It's a huge mess. There's a lot of finger pointing going on, but I'll defer to my colleagues here, to the rest of you, on her assertion that if it was a man that was saying this stuff and a man acting like she had and speaking like she had, that everyone would see it as strong leadership. She says, you know, as you saw in that Little Miss Muffet Vestal Virgin sort of references, that she feels that she's being picked on as a woman.
I'll take a different stance. Well, certainly everyone knew, you know, Rahm liked to use the F-bomb, and it was sort of like, ha, 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 that's what he does. But I almost think that she would have, you know, actually encouraged the leak of this report, because it makes it look like she's standing up for Cook County taxpayers. I mean, the racist stuff, certainly, if that happened, that is a problem. But someone who is angry at this company that, by some accounts, you know, has cost some taxing bodies millions of dollars in loans they had to pay, and that she's standing up and getting angry, I could see that as a mayoral campaign commercial for her. Look who fights for you, Maria Pappas.
Well, I guess my concern about, like, the would I be getting this kind of heat if I were a woman claim is that even when a man does behave this way,
It's
not okay,
okay
then either.
Yeah, that's not
toxic
the
masculinity.
That
right?
Shouldn't yeah, be like the standard, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Right. I think Tyler Technologies, you know, Dan, you mentioned it, said, you know, your colleagues might be used to this, but it's still unacceptable. President Preckwinkle had a pretty serious response to it, saying they were going to look into it. So more to come on that.
Yeah, she's referred it to human rights and ethics officials. And yeah, I mean, I thought that was a pretty strong statement. Remember, this comes in the middle of a race where Preckwinkle is seeking another term, and she has a pretty formidable challenger, or at least well-funded challenger, in Alderman Brendan Riley in the upcoming Democratic primary on March 17th. So she's come into criticism, Preckwinkle has, as well as Pappas and Tyler Technologies as their contractor. But, you know, who's overseeing this contract for all these years, and why did it all just blow up really in the past year?
A lot of questions there. This is In the Loop. I'm Mariah Wolfel in for Sasha Ann Simons, and we're going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap with WTTW's Brandis Friedman, Monica Ang of Axios, and WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos. A lot of us saw the frightening video last weekend of chaos in Mexico after the capture and death of a Mexican cartel leader. Monica, weren't there some Chicagoans visiting areas like Puerto Vallarta when this violence broke out?
Yeah, dozens and dozens. And I happened to speak to Jonathan Pizer, who is an aide to Representative Quigley. And he was down there, and we got on a Facebook video call that night. And he told me his harrowing story about, you know, driving a couple of Chicago friends out to go whale watching, having their car stopped, having a gun put in their face. And he was told to get out. They drove the car a few yards, threw a bomb in it, and he watched his car explode in front of him. His partner, his husband, Brad Lippitz, who was a prominent real estate agent in Chicago, he went one way. The other two Chicago friends went another. Brad was hiding in an orphanage for at least 8 hours as the streets remained unsafe, and finally got home late that night after I'd talked to Jonathan. And they said they were terrified. But, you know, at the end, I said, well, what do you want Chicagoans to know? And I was shocked at what he said. He said that it could have been a lot worse, that that we escaped with our lives. It did not seem like they wanted to kill us, but they did want to block the roads. And it seemed like there were about 250 roads that were blocked around the country, especially to transportation hubs.
And, of course, so many locals still dealing with
the aftermath.
All of this aftermath. On a bit more of a positive note, blues legend Buddy Guy is making his pitch for a blues monument in Chicago. Sticking with you, Monica, what would he want to see?
Well, it was really interesting because I think we were both at City Hall that day when they were honoring him, and we were like, speech after speech after speech from all the aldermen. And then finally, this 89-year-old gentleman gets up, and is very quiet, very soft-spoken, speaks for about 49 seconds, and basically says, I get jealous when I go to Nashville or New Orleans or Texas, and they really celebrate their music there. You can see it in the airports. He's like, I'd like to know when Chicago might have a monument that says Chicago's the world home of the blues. Didn't hear much from the mayor's office or D-Case on this, but I did talk to Byron Sigcho Lopez, a friend of the family. He says he's moving along. He says he's working with D-Case. He said he had worked with the previous commissioner, who's now gone, and now he's working with the new commissioner, and a CPS. I actually did a story for Curious City when I was here asking why we don't teach Chicago music history in CPS, and there was a curriculum, and so maybe Sigcho Lopez can get that restarted, because we've got so many amazing musicians, so much great history here. Why not work that into the curriculum?
Yeah, that's a great idea. Also in Axios, a Waymo self-driving car could be pulling up near you. A limited fleet has arrived in Chicago, but it's still in the early phases of mapping and data collection, and we'll have drivers in the cars. But, you know, Monica, your colleague Justin Kaufman at Axios has been using Waymo to get around in Phoenix. I just want to open it up to the panel in the few minutes we have left here. Would any of you order a ride with a driverless Waymo? And start with you, Monica.
I think I'd still be a little afraid. As I was watching Justin's video of, like, you know, like a car moving with no person at the wheel, it just made the mother in me very nervous.
I can't.
I think I'd try it.
Yeah?
Yes. So I feel like this technology is certainly not perfected yet, but the idea of a driverless vehicle sounds awesome to me if the car drives like I do, and I may or may not have a lead foot. The point is this. I could get so much done just riding in the car, having to worry about steering and traffic.
Well, Justin said in his review that I was afraid it was going to be hesitant, but it was really zipping fast. I'm like, no, I don't want that.
No, I mean, I'm that's good. That. I'll try it.
The reason you named is why I love the bus, but the bus isn't there on time as much as an Uber.
And you have to share it with other people. Yeah. I mean, they're great. Other people are great, but.
Dan, you getting in a Waymo driverless car anytime soon?
I think I'm going to stick with those drivers that like to listen to, you know, most of them are from other countries and like to listen to our local NPR station when they're in the car. And sometimes my voice
that's
will come on
so
when
true.
I'm in the car, and they're like,
that's me, that's me.
I'm like, that's me. They're like, you don't sound like that. I'm like, that's because
yes,
it went up through a satellite and back down to your car. But yeah, I mean, but we forget, though, people make a lot of mistakes, too. I mean, people, drivers are distracted increasingly, and sometimes not just by what they're listening to on the radio, by what's on their phones.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guthman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.